This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. At the dawn of the 21st century, U.S. retail giant Walmart has emerged as the kind of world-transforming economic institution that General Motors and the Pennsylvania Railroad had been in America's past. Already the U.S.'s biggest employer, estimates are that Walmart will double its sales and employ at least 2.2 million worldwide by 2008.
Beginning in Arkansas in the Ozarks, Walmart came from a region of the country where a kind of low-wage, low-benefit, almost rural American world was the norm. Clearly, Walmart, now the largest firm in the nation today, is setting a standard that other firms have to follow if they hope to compete.
The Walmart-led race to the bottom is seen in the U.S. in its retail stores and abroad in the manufacturers it selects to produce the products it sells. It has reversed a 100-year-old history in which the manufacturer was powerful and the retailer was the vassal. Now the mass global retailer is the power and the manufacturer becomes the underling who has to do the bidding of the retailer. The manufacturers that Walmart selects are increasingly located in underdeveloped countries, which must compete for Walmart's business, leading to a ratcheting down of already low wages and working conditions in the underdeveloped economies around the world.
Labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein is one of the leading analysts of the new discipline, which we can almost call Walmart Studies. He helped to organize a path-breaking conference, Walmart, Template for 21st Century Capitalism, at the University of Santa Barbara. Now, Nelson Lichtenstein.
Today I want to talk about the sense of this company and other companies like it in the global economy and what I think is new and what I think is different and what is similar to other moments of globalization. I mean, we've had world trade for 200 years. What is new? And I think the essence of it is this, that for the great retailers of our day, of which Walmart's first among them, but also Carrefour in France and Home Depot and Target, and you can name a whole bunch of them, these companies have now achieved a central strategic place in world capitalism, you know, at the center of the supply chain. This phrase, supply chain, is kind of a, frankly, I hadn't encountered it until about 3 years ago. It's now the buzzword in all the business schools and everywhere else. I mean, in one sense, all it means is how do goods get from when they're produced to where they're sold. In previous eras, if General Motors was producing cars, it had a distribution network. The sort of the mental map of the world was the manufacturer, and then they distributed in some fashion. With the retailers at the center of this new world, the phrase supply chain, it reverses that sense that how did the stuff get there? How did it, the retailer sucks it in and then it is sold and the manufacturer, the producer, these become kind of a long tail on the retailing dog. I think this becomes graphically apparent in my days as an academic tourist. I visited, I think recently, the two great nodes of contemporary capitalism, and the first was Bentonville, and the place is booming, of course. You see, you can go to the Walmart World Headquarters they want, which is, you know, it's there, but then all around it are the offices of the vendors, Procter & Gamble, Gillette, Johnson & Johnson, Levi Strauss. 500-700, they're called vendors, they're basically the producers. They have brought their offices to this little town called Bentonville. It's like something out of the, you know, where the courtiers went to the king's court in the Middle Ages or something. Why are they there? Because Walmart is buying 10, 20, 30% of everything they make. They have to be there to negotiate this down to the millimeter of the shelf space down, you know, and Walmart will tell them we've got to change the packaging, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're all there. I was there, and I was given a tour around the town by the wife, interesting, the wife of a vendor guy. The entire day we spent together, she was showing me all the mansions of the new executives and everything, and this was the best job in her husband's company, to be in Bentonville, because that was the biggest client, and that was sort of the road upward, you know, for this guy and for thousands of other people of that sort. So that's Bentonville, Arkansas. Half a world away, literally, is the second great node of world capitalism. I think southern China, Guangdong Province, which I visited in September. And of course, it is also a booming. The province itself now has 110 million people. 30 to 40 million of these are recent migrants in the last several years from the countryside. Shenzhen is a city of 7 million. It used to be a couple hundred thousand 20 years ago. The skylines of these cities, Guangzhou, which is the old canton, and when we drove across them, we thought this is something out of a science fiction movie because modernist skyscrapers, but you know, as in a science fiction kind of, it doesn't have the resonance of the New York skyline or the, you know, the, or some other familiar urban skyline. It was all brand new, so it had kind of like a computer game. It had that flavor to it. And we also, I remember with this moment of revelation, we're driving across this urban industrial landscape for an hour. We're driving past factories, past dormitories, past machine shops. I'm thinking, this is familiar. This was like West Grand Avenue in Detroit in 1928. I mean, this was a kind of, it sort of throbbed. It smelled, it vibrated. It was like the old industrial belt of America with this enormous chaos, but also vitality. And of course, it's from Guangdong Province that a third of all of China's exports come, and of that, 10% goes directly to Walmart's shelves. Now, Walmart itself owns no factories in China, although it now has 11 stores in Guangdong Province and some 45 in the country, and it'll soon have many, many more than that. But Walmart is feared and respected by everyone involved with any aspect of the export trade, which is why executives at the Yantian International Container Terminal we visited, and everyone in America, everyone who's interested in labor, must visit a container terminal. It could be in Newark, LA, or Shenzhen, but you must do it. It embodies the essence of global trade, and you find, you know, miles of huge containers, thousands of them stacked up. When we were there, we asked them, tell us about your relationship to Walmart, and there was a little tittering. And they said, Walmart is king. In other words, when they have to get their toys from a little factory in province to the shelves in Peoria around September, that's when you ship toys, you know, the Walmart shipments go first. You know, they have priority because they're such a huge proportion of the shipments out of South China and out of this particular port. And South China is different from the export zones of Mexico or the Caribbean. They are, in fact, building real infrastructure. And the capital in China, while there is American capital and European capital, is also Taiwanese, South Korean, Japanese, and, of course, domestic Chinese capital. It's not just this sort of cheap labor investment where, you know, as in the maquiladoras today are declining workforce and sort of disinvestment because, you know, they've gone on to China. This is significant. This makes China a kind of a place that will, you know, it's going to be there. This is not just one place, one more place where cheap labor is found. One Walmart executive put it this way, describing why Walmart is in China. It's often described as a joint venture, meaning that the company has a joint venture with elements of the Chinese government, sometimes local, sometimes national. And he said, there might be places in other parts of the world where you can buy cheaper, but can you get the product on the ship? If we have to look at a country that's not politically stable, you might not get your order on time. If you deal in a country where the currency fluctuations every day, there is a lot of risk. China happens to have the right mix. At least that's what Walmart thinks right now. It's stable, it's cheap, it's not the cheapest, but it's predictable. That was clearly the thing, very interesting, talking to these managers at this container port, that was the thing. We will guarantee the stuff in Los Angeles in 22 days once it comes to airport. Well, the workforce in Guangdong, like that of other coastal provinces, is overwhelmingly composed of migrants from the inland villages. The men work in construction and the women in export manufacture and commerce. Factory wages are low, about $100 a month, but far higher than in agriculture, and they are rising fairly quickly because the labor shortage generated by the export boom in toys, garments, shoes, and electronic devices. But as in apartheid South Africa, or along the employment pathways carved by so many Mexican workers in the U.S., these millions of migrants are essentially stateless or half stateless. Because their official residence remains the home village, migrant workers in coastal China do not have access to the social services or adequate housing so long as they are without residence permits. They work and reside on the sufferance of their employer, which often holds their identity papers until they complete their labor contract. This is why so many factories throw up huge dormitories, some housing 8 or 12 workers to a room, almost always women, where residence is dependent upon employment at the enterprise next door. Women workers who are fired or get pregnant are practically compelled to return to their home village. Marriage is difficult because there is so little affordable housing for couples who work in the contract manufacturing sector. Neither Bentonville nor Guangdong just happened. These anchors of the Trans-Pacific supply chain are not the product of some abstract process of globalization, but rather both were constructed by a set of political and policy choices in the U.S. and throughout the globe that have shifted power from manufacturing to retail distribution, and from an economy in which the interests of the relatively high-wage men played a central role to one in which the flexible, low-wage labor of women is increasingly crucial. If you look at Walmart, you can see that just as in China, it doesn't own the factories. In the U.S. as well, Walmart doesn't own the toothpaste factories or the lawnmower factories or all the products it gets. But increasingly, Walmart is a de facto manufacturing company because although it technically doesn't own it, in fact, it is structuring the way these manufacturers function in a very intimate fashion. I mean, when these people put their offices in Bentonville, what they're doing, they're in intimate contact with Walmart, and they're constantly processing negotiation over the character of the products that they're going to produce and the price and the shape of them. And given the enormous buying power that Walmart has, the negotiation is clearly not one of equals. In fact, when Gillette just merged with P&G just last year, a $57 billion merger, what was that all about? Well, it was so that, hopefully, from the point of view of Gillette and P&G, they could be big enough to have a kind of negotiating power with Walmart. Most people don't think they're big enough. They're now, what, a $70 billion company. They aren't big enough to really negotiate and really hold their own against Walmart. And I don't know if you know, maybe we're in New York, so everyone is sort of, I can get it for you wholesale, but sort of the New York commercial culture. It used to be that, you know, companies like P&G and Hearts Mountain and clothing manufacturers, they were kind of bullies when it came to the retail sector. They would go in there and say, we demand X number of feet of shelf, or put our stuff right in the front of the store, or whatever it was. Not anymore. That kind of relationship has completely been reversed. One of the key reasons for that, which gets back to this question of what angle of vision do you see production from the point of view of the manufacturer or the point of view of the retailer, container ships from China are not pushed across the Pacific. That is, pushed in the sense that the manufacturer puts the stuff on the ship and pushes it to the consumer or to the retailer. No, they are pulled across the Pacific in the sense that the retailer knows exactly what they want because they're completely computerized. They know what their sales are, and so they pull it. We need, you know, 500,000, you know, gross of X by next Thursday, so they pull it across. So when you buy a tube of toothpaste at any major retailer today, the information that you've bought that goes directly not just to the retailer's headquarters, but to the manufacturer's headquarters. And that manufacturing headquarters could be in Cincinnati for P&G, and then meanwhile it goes directly to the offshore factory that produces the toothpaste, and without anyone sending an invoice, without anyone ordering it, there's a kind of upward spike, you know, in the production because the information has gone instantly to wherever it is, China, Mexico, to produce more of that stuff. So that's what I mean by pulling. Production is pulled from the factory to the retail shelf. One reason that Walmart has become such a massive retail phenomenon, and it's also true for Home Depot and all the big retailers. I don't want to demonize Walmart particularly. There are things that are unique about it, but I think that in the general scheme of things, Walmart is setting the pace, but others will follow. Walmart grew dramatically in the era of Reagan. There were two things that happened then that were particularly fortuitous in terms of Walmart's growth. The first was the minimum wage. Retailing is very labor intensive. There are 1.3 million employees at Walmart right now in the United States. 2 years ago, the number of retail workers, not service workers, but just retail workers, it became larger than the number of factory workers in the U.S. It's very labor intensive. Therefore, and discount retailing is very sensitive to the labor costs. The reason that Walmart's always breaking the law is because there's all these incentives to do so for its managers. Anyway, in the 1960s, when Sam Walton got started, and he was a genius at retailing, but he also understood the dynamics of it, he repeatedly broke the minimum wage law by various connivances in Arkansas. The courts, the feds caught up with him by the late 60s, and he was forced to pay higher wages, incorporate, etc. But history, as it were, came to Walton's rescue. in the 70s, we entered a period of stagflation, and by 1975, 76, the minimum wage began to plunge rapidly downward. And unlike a Kmart, which was headquartered in near Detroit, and where in part its wage level was, you know, influenced by the auto industry, etc., Walton in Arkansas, and in this what had been a very depressed area of the country, is able to take advantage of this downward plunge in the minimum wage. And the 70s were the era, the miracle decade for Walmart, in which it went from a little $40 million a year firm to $1 billion a year firm and was on its way. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, of course, the evisceration of the labor law, the destruction of it. And here again, while it's very difficult, it always has been difficult to organize young, rapidly, well, women work, women retail clerks who are rapidly turning over, where you have high turnover. It is difficult to organize them. Can be done, of course, but and much attention is focused on the organization of the retail clerks in a Walmart or somewhere else. But actually, there was a very definite threat of unionization at Walmart in the early 1970s. It didn't come at the front end of the store. It came at the back in the distribution centers. And Walmart broke the unionization drives in the 70s by pioneering in the use of anti-union consultants, which was only beginning in the early 70s, and has remained tremendously vigilant on that question, in particular in the distribution centers and the truck drivers. He's also, by the way, has higher wages for those people, mainly men, but he's been very careful about that question. So you have the two things, the decline in the minimum wage, the destruction of the labor law, certainly in retailing, and what that means is a kind of policy vacuum is created into which Walmart can flourish. And the other side, of course, is healthcare, which we know about. Here I have a wonderful little pamphlet, Why Labor Needs Improved and Expanded Medicare for All, put out by the Labor's Case for Single-Payer National Health Insurance by the PNHP. But I mean, that also, of course, is a great saving. The fact that there's a policy vacuum when it comes to healthcare in America meant that Walmart can take advantage of that. So you have this, the growth of this retail sector in the U.S. is not just a kind of natural product of globalization or of technological change, cheaper distribution. It reflects the vacuum of in policy, social policy, generated by the Reagan era. Another famous element of the Walmart model is, we don't hear about it today as much, but it was very famous in the 80s, was by the Buy America campaign. The kind of cultural aura which surrounds Walmart and which has given it a kind of boost in some ways was, hey, this company, at least this was true 10 years ago, and it still adheres to it a little bit, this company is sort of an American company, Buy America. And Walton, famously in the mid-80s, with actually the help of Bill Clinton, began this Buy America campaign. Now, today, of course, hypocrisy. They were beginning to get their goods from China. You know, there were a few American goods they were sort of advertising in a big way, but basically hypocrisy. Well, that's true, but there was something even more important than hypocrisy going on. The technique for generating the subordinate relationship of the manufacturer, whether it's in China or Mexico or Arkansas, to the retailer was developed during the Buy American campaign. Because what Walmart did, with Bill Clinton's help, and Bill Clinton was sort of governor of Arkansas then, what they did was they found these manufacturing firms in the Mid-South, which were paying low wages, which were, you know, shirt manufacturers, apparel manufacturers, and Walmart said, okay, we want to buy from you. And they said, but to buy from you, you've got to, you know, do our bidding. So they sent consultants to these little companies and said, okay, here's how you manufacture shirts, etc. You don't have the right fabric? We'll import the fabric for you from Pakistan or Turkey or Taiwan, which they did. And here's how you produce it. You know, we're going to show you how to produce it. And of course, when it came to unionization, forget about that. And there was a famous case at a Ferris Fabrics in Arkansas where a unionization effort was made by the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And the owner of the company said, look, we're going to lose our contract if there's a union here. The Walmart is watching everything. So the techniques for the subordination of manufacturing to retail are really worked out in the Buy America campaign. And when you read Discount Store News, which is the main publication of this industry, they excoriate Walmart for both the hypocrisy of the Buy America campaign, but also for kind of the hollowing out of domestic manufacturing. There's one quote here. It says here, Walmart's Buy America program proved a public relations coup historic in its dimensions, rude Discount Store News, which reflected the chagrin of the Bentonville retailer's competitors. By 1986, Walmart stores were festooned with red, white, and blue Buy American banners and signs on the counters that proclaimed This item, formerly imported, is now being purchased by Walmart in the USA and is creating or retaining jobs for Americans. But Walmart's retailers said what's really happening here is, let me see if I got it here, is that Walmart's highly proactive approach to product development may unintentionally be making American business less competitive. Because Walmart now sets the parameters of product development, companies like his are no longer manufacturers. This is from the industry itself. Instead, they are becoming sources who produce only the products that Walmart has decided it wants to sell, which in turn make R&D and introduction of new products redundant and unprofitable. But once you've established that template in the U.S., you take it to China, and that's exactly what they've done in a big way in the last decade and a half. Now, what's going on sort of back in China? You know, when we visited a Nike factory there, well, we thought it was a Nike factory at first. We were welcomed by Nike executives. We were given a wonderful meal. There were Nike signs, there were pictures of the sports stars that Nike had. It turned out it wasn't a Nike factory. What it was a factory by Yuyen, which is a global shoe manufacturer, which has factories all over China and Vietnam, 250,000 workers. The factory we visited in Guangdong province had 25,000, mainly women workers. Nike was there, yes, they were there, but they were kind of symbiotically meshed with this Chinese company. They were determining the brand, they were determining the design, but the actual production, the actual capital was owned by this, it was a Taiwanese company now becoming Chinese. And this is what's happening. And so the question of the brand, this becomes kind of the issue. Who controls the brand? Nike? Was that Nike welcomed American academics like myself because they were proud of their brand. They thought we would, in a sense, be advertisers for their brand. And I can report to you that the Nike factory, the Yuyen factory there, was clean. It was legal. The dormitories existed. They were not rat infested. I can report all that to you. That's what they wanted me. I'm reporting it to you. Of course, the legal context and the social context within which all that took place is another story. But they do have a code of corporate responsibility, which is probably the best among codes of corporate responsibility. When we talked to NGOs in Hong Kong, left-wing people, they said, look, you've got to understand, the people with the well-structured brand image, and brands are worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, even if they don't own the factory, it's the disembodied idea which is important, they've got to protect that. So therefore, they're going to give you a good meal and show you around and have clean dormitory rooms and even have libraries and discos for the women workers, although that's sort of a Potemkin village kind of thing. Walmart, on the other hand, really has the best of both worlds from the point of view of brands. Walmart itself is a brand. You go to brand Walmart, you know it's cheap, so that's a brand. On the other hand, any individual product at Walmart is debranded, is not a brand. So the kind of leverage that students and others in America can put onto the Nike can't really be put onto Walmart. You can't boycott Walmart. That's impossible. You could boycott an individual Nike. You could boycott that and you'd have some leverage, but you can't boycott Walmart. It's too big. And this was graphically shown to us when the production manager at Yuyen drove with us to the local Walmart. We went to the shoe department and he was contemptuous of the shoes in this Walmart store because, yes, their workmanship was inferior, but they had no brand. And he said, you know, what is this? It's sort of just this commodity. And he was just infuriated because he had been taught over, I guess, several years, the brand, defend Nike's brand. So that's why Walmart, when it comes to corporate responsibility, and there are these codes, and you can go to the Walmart website, they have an elaborate corporate responsibility set up, and they claim 300 or 400, you know, inspectors, and they have a whole red light, green light, yellow light sort of system, but it is violated repeatedly. And all the NGOs we talked to in Hong Kong said, Walmart is the worst. They're always violating their code. They don't really enforce their own code. And the key to that is that there's no way to get leverage on them in the same way you can get leverage on a Nike or some piece of higher fashion apparel. As one of them said, Walmart is the dirty king of South China. And they're actually kind of elaborate studies, and you know that what happens is Walmart's computers tell its buyers, we're selling this toy, and it's doing great. Send a message to China. We need, you know, another 10,000 gross of this thing. And so some little factory there in South China gets a message, a telex or something, from Bentonville or from Shenzhen and says, you know, we need 10,000 gross of this toy or whatever it is, some huge amount, 3 weeks. And so instantly the women workers are working, you know, 20 hours a day or maybe 18 hours a day and all the kind of terrible labor things we think of. And since no one's ever heard of this toy, since it has no brand, there's no leverage to stop that, at least from the point of view of outside. And just to end to say that, of course, South China is not a stable situation. The Chinese, their own security bureau, I guess it's sort of Ministry of Public Security. Boy, there's an Orwellian name for you, right? It reports that there are some 70,000, what do they call them? Not exactly protests, but disruptions every year. Many in North China, but an increasingly large number in South China. And I think the report, another report just came out, it's gone up by 10 or 20%. Tremendous amount of this. Many of these protests are against local managers, local governments for corruption, local situations. They seem to be directed less toward the national government than toward local authorities, specific employers, and corrupt officials. They have not, and seem unlikely, to achieve the national character of the solidarity movement that challenged the communist regime in Poland a quarter century ago. They have a far more local, although hardly a parochial, thrust, seeking to pressure factory managers and provincial officials to live up to Chinese labor and environmental laws, as well as to the specific employment contracts and working conditions promises which brought so many to Guangdong's factory districts in the first place. The protesters are fighting for the kind of democratic citizenship that will liberate them from a workplace regime that has left them in a purgatory, half stateless and half free. As they push back against this system, they begin to crack the chains, supply chain as well as others, that have given Walmart and its retail competitors such overweening power in the global economy.
You've been listening to labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein.
It was summer 05 when Walmart and I signed the biggest deal of the year. They gave me a pin and a smiley face grin and said, "Garth, boy, you'll love it here." But I had my doubts, so I went to find out what's hidden behind Walmart's smirk. I opened that door, my jaw hit the floor. That's one f***ed up place to work. Now I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. Don't get caught bitching. Their healthcare plan fits on two pages, so they're sick and tired and contagious. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. Now one thing I've learned, when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights, stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions, 'cause the union's missing. It's time for us to be courageous and stop these union busting outrages. 'Cause I don't need any more friends with low wages. Yeehaw!
Special thanks to American Rights at Work for the Walmart Garth Brooks parody song.
This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special.